This podcast is brought to you by the Albany Public Library Main Branch and the generosity of listeners like you.
What is a podcast?
God, Daddy, these people talk as much as you do. Razib Khan's Unsupervised Learning.
Even if you and your partner are healthy, there's still a chance your child can develop a serious genetic disease. This is because every embryo has new changes not present in either parent. Most of the time, these are benign, but sometimes they can be catastrophic. ORCID's whole genome embryo reports directly screen the embryo and analyze these de novo genetic mutations. Discuss embryo screening and IVF with a genetics expert.
Hey, everybody. This is Razib with the Unsupervised Learning Podcast, and today I am here with Jeremy Carl. Jeremy is a friend of mine. I've known him for a while. I mean, I think I've known you since 2016, Jeremy.
Before that. Well, before that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Many years. I don't want to date us. But so Jeremy is here IRL with me, just so you guys know. If there's like a tussle or a conflict over our discussion, you understand why. But he is a fellow at Claremont Institute right now, and he's got a new book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Now, I know some of you complain my intros get a little too long, but I do think I do need to like set the stage here. A title like this, obviously, Jeremy, is very provocative. And, you know, I think a lot of the listeners, you know, when they hear anti-white racism, it's kind of a joke, or, you know, they'll put quotation marks. The premise seems, I think, ludicrous to them on the face of it. I don't personally find it ludicrous, but, some people do. Can you just address that before we talk about the book?
Sure. And actually, it's funny that you say that the book's title is provocative, and it is, and it was intentional. And it's funny because the book is, in and of itself, I actually try to be less provocative. But I'd originally wanted to title this book, It's Okay to Be White. I actually got the editors to go along with that, and then ultimately the sales staff killed it because they're like, we can't sell that book to Costco and Walmart, which in and of itself was interesting. And for those of your listeners who are more online types, they'll kind of recognize that not just as a statement, but as a kind of thing that was a right-wing 4chan meme, that these sort of signs that said that sort of showed up in various places, and it caused outrage. And that was sort of the point, because of course it's okay to be Asian, it's okay to be Black, it's okay to be Hispanic, and it should also be okay to be white. But of course, in the discourse, that's not true at all. And so I think that in and of itself was a little bit of a confirmation of my theme. But yeah, for the book, I was trying to not hide the ball. I was trying to talk about some of these issues really, really clearly. And I'd seen a lot of sort of synonyms flying around. A lot of times you'll see wokeness or various euphemisms. And I wanted to be really direct about what I was talking about, and hopefully be able to convince kind of fair-minded people, even if they're somewhat skeptical, that my thesis was true.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess like the issue here is like anti-white racism. The term itself kind of reflects, you know, the uniqueness of it insofar as racism. When we think of racism, it is from white people to non-white people. So you have to say anti-white, because racism in the American mind triggers white people doing things to non-white people, mostly Native Americans and Blacks, but more recently, you know, the term people of color in general. And so you have to say anti-white racism, or in the past, people used to say reverse racism. I'm going to be honest, I thought that term was retarded just because racism is racism. So I don't get it. But can you talk about your ideas and your thesis in the context of kind of the regnant ideology of white supremacy and white racism in the United States right now, 2024?
Right. Well, that's a good question. And I think a couple things sort of going on there that are worth mentioning. The first is, of course, that as you kind of noted, we have this regnant ideology. There are sort of folks much further to my right that have a problem even with the term racism, for essentially the reasons that you just said, that it's almost a term that's coded against white people per se in our current parlance, and so therefore they prefer anti-whiteism or something like that. I just prefer to call it anti-white racism. But I think you could do one of those, either of those two things. But I think it's understandable that folks, you know, may find that triggering if they're not on it. But the kind of way I compare it is, it's not a coincidence that the term white privilege, for example, which starts with a Wellesley academic in 1988, is the first person to really coin this, happens right at the moment that I would argue maybe we were kind of at the cusp of getting rid of the last white privilege on net. It's sort of like, if you're complaining about Kim Jong-un's totalitarianism, you probably don't live in North Korea. You probably live somewhere very safely outside. And so I think it's not a coincidence. And in fact, when you kind of do the Google trends on the phrases white privilege and white supremacy and all these things, there's been a huge uptick in it in these last few years, whereas times, if you were to go back 100 years ago, when white supremacy actually reigned in large parts of the U.S., you don't find reference to it. And so I think that is sort of an important thing to keep in mind. And I should also just kind of add, without backing off my thesis at all, in no way in writing this book am I suggesting, of course, that there aren't other types of racism that are very prevalent in today. I know you've experienced some of that online. We've talked about that. And certainly in America's past, right? So this is not an attempt to kind of rewrite history or pretend that other things aren't going on. It's simply to say that it, particularly in a legal context, anti-white racism and anti-white prejudice and discrimination are the dominant modes of that today.
Well, I mean, so before we go on, you said legal context, and we're going to talk about civil rights law and those sorts of things. But what are white people? Who's white?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and it's an interesting question. And of course, this is something that has been the subject of many, many books by scholars from all over the political spectrum. What I would say is, I'm kind of using the common parlance definition. In 1790, when we passed the Naturalization Act, and they talk about white people, you know, you kind of have to be white to kind of go be a citizen. There was no confusion about what that meant. It meant Jews. It meant Italians. I mean, there obviously weren't that many of either of those groups. It would have meant any group that was kind of seen as at all white. And there was really, as far as I know, no meaningful ambiguity in that statement. Now, of course, throughout history, you can go look, and I write about this in the book. I mean, you can find the no Irish need apply, or anti-Semitism, or certainly hierarchies within whiteness, okay? But I'm just using the very commonly accepted definition. You know, I walk out on the street and somebody's going to see me as a white guy. If I apply for a job, I'm going to check the white box and everything that flows from that.
Yeah, let me just like clarify here to what Jeremy is saying. There's this idea that Irish became white. Well, you know, as Jeremy just implied here, there was never a debate whether they could be naturalized. So in 1790, there was a law that limited naturalization to white people. And the Irish were white by that definition, even if they were treated as second-class citizens, they were persecuted, all those things. That's true. And they were not seen as maybe white in the same way, maybe not fully white culturally, socially, but legally it was understood that the Irish were white because they were naturalized. And a lot of this was also done via lower courts. And so there were some ambiguous cases, mostly in that zone between the Eastern Mediterranean and Northern India. So Syrians fell just on the correct side of the line of white, where the courts would begrudgingly accept them as white, but just barely. So Arabs, you know, Levantines, those sorts of people, barely white. And, you know, during this period, they're mostly Syrian Christians from what became Lebanon and Syria, Maronite Catholics and whatnot. North Indians, you know, there's a famous case of, I forget the name, like, but there's a famous case of a guy from Punjab, a blue-eyed Punjabi guy. And, you know, he tried to say, like, look, I'm an Aryan and I am like a Caucasian person. And the court basically said, look, you're right about all that, but like, it is not the commonly defined way to say white. And so therefore, we're going to remove your naturalization, because he was naturalized by a lower court.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned this case, because I talk about it in my book, and I'm just blanking on the guy's name as well. I actually think he was a Parsi. So even sort of more interestingly on the side of the line, and I've lived in India, so I kind of have context for that. But just so your readers who are not familiar, this is basically an Indian of largely Persian descent. Okay, so it's kind of even more on that ambiguous line. And I think, again, it's illustrative of what actual white supremacy looked like. These people were desperately trying in the early 20th century to claim whiteness, okay, legally for the advantage. What I document in the book and in many other places, of course, is you see the exact opposite now. You see a flight from whiteness in a massive way. So you have 10x the number of Native Americans now than you had 50 years ago in the census. And this is not because of some Native American birth boom. It's because of the advantages, formal and informal, of being identified as Native American. And you're seeing a collapse in Hispanics who are identifying as white, even though still a lot of them do. And similarly, people want to get out of that identity in general. And there's lots of documentation of this, including by left-wing scholars. I mean, this is not primarily right-wingers who have kind of dominated this type of discourse. And so I think the onus is on the people who kind of talk about white privilege to say, well, if it's such a privilege to be white in the current environment, why is everybody, especially at least in the legal sense, running away from whiteness in such a eager way?
So this is relevant right now because I guess this is relevant right now in terms of the definition of whiteness, because it is legally now shrinking. They are now removing Middle Eastern people from the white category, which, I mean, socially they were not white, but legally they were white, which did cause some weird. So there are people from Egypt who can pass as African American, but legally they're white.
But there are also people. I mean, there are also people like Casey Kasem. Even he, I mean, he didn't have such light skin, but he coded so culturally as white. He was Christian, and he was sort of, you know, a mid-century Lebanese kind of guy who just coded as like an all-American guy. So I think there obviously were these sorts of ambiguous cases, but you're right that they're even further carving out in the census new groups that are kind of not going to be white. And this, of course, will spill over into job and hiring preferences and everything else.
Well, so, Jeremy, I wanted you to talk about the 1960s Civil Rights Act, white flight. I mean, all that stuff is in your book, and like how that kind of created the world we're in right now, the historical context.
Absolutely. And before I do that, there was just something I want to mention. I think you know Eric Kaufman, right? Is he? Yeah. So Eric Kaufman, who's a mutual friend of ours, has actually written, and it's a book I reference a lot in my own book. So in addition to sort of shilling for my book, for folks who are interested in this issue, I definitely recommend Eric Kaufman's book, White Shift. He's a Canadian scholar. He's at the University of Buckingham now in the UK. And he's kind of written, he's himself multiracial, but kind of maybe phenotypically white or white-ish. And he's kind of talked about the sort of birth of this multiracial whiteness almost as maybe kind of a way out of some of this. But to go back and address your issue of the Civil Rights Act. So Richard Hanania, Chris Caldwell, Chris is a Claremont colleague of mine. Richard's a friend of mine, and I think yours as well, even though I have a lot of disagreements with him. But they've both written about this, and others have, kind of the importance of civil rights laws in terms of getting us where we were today, particularly starting with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which Chris Caldwell calls kind of America's second constitution. And he insists that there's a lot of fundamental tensions between this and our original constitution. Now, Chris has a wonderful talent for sort of writing opaquely and evasively enough in certain respects that he can still write for the New York Times while having some pretty edgy opinions on things. I've tried to be a little bit more direct, and his book is terrific, and he's a really interesting thinker. I don't think it's useful either strategically or intellectually to kind of relitigate the 1964 Act. I think it was responding to some real problems of anti-minority discrimination that were going on in the country at the time. It was a blunt instrument. It was largely effective at accomplishing those short-term goals. But I do think it's fair to say that it also sowed the seeds for a lot of this reversal that happened later, and that many of the things, the problems we're dealing with now are kind of eventually spun out of that. I think it's just useful to say we are as far away in time from that as they were from the Wright brothers. So there's a lot of water that's gone under the bridge since then. Another interesting thing is beyond the act itself, it was all the subsequent acts. It was the way that the deep state / administrative state interpreted the act and put in all sorts of things. And it's actually fascinating when you read the congressional debates around the act. There's all sorts of things in the debate where...